It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the effort to elect a Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and look ahead at the big issues facing a divided Congress. First, the U.S. and China are tied together by international trade. China is the top source of imports to the United States, and it's the third biggest market for products from the United States, behind Canada and Mexico, and for products from Wisconsin. In American politics, there have been concerns about a trade deficit with China, and more recently, international political rivalry has raised security fears about dependence on China, from machinery to computer chips to social media. But untangling those business connections could be way easier said than done. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the U.S. Economic connections with China? Do you buy or avoid materials marked with that Made in China label? Does that matter to you at all? What questions do you have about the economic connections between the often political rivals? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And if your business relies on selling stuff to China or buying stuff from China, love to hear from you as well. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Zoe Liu is Fellow for International Political Economy at the Council on Foreign Relations. Zoe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thank you very much for having me.
I spelled out some of the basics there. Can you talk a little bit more about how interconnected the American economy is with the Chinese economy?
Yes, absolutely. And I think you've already gave us a very good and a very solid overview in terms of the trade relationship between the two countries, right? And indeed, exactly as you said, despite the trade war since the Trump administration's especially escalating starting from 2018, China and the U.S. trade is still very much tied together. And by 2021, China was the largest trading partner of the United States, and by a lot of measures, trading with China actually have created more than 2 million jobs on a yearly basis. And then on top of that, if we think about people-to-people exchanges, prior to the pandemic, every year China has been sending a lot of Chinese students to study in America. And Wisconsin is actually one of the top destinations for Chinese students to study in America.
This has been controversial, though, since we went from zero trade with China, more or less, in the early 1970s to opening of trade ties. Can you talk about the benefits we've seen in the U.S., especially in terms of cheaper stuff, and the costs, especially in terms of losing factories in some cases?
Yes, absolutely. So in terms of the benefit, right, trading with China, there are the goods, the bads, and the ugly. So let's start with the goods. I think from a consumer's perspective, the most significant or the most significant benefit would be cheaper imported goods from China, from toys to TVs or computers or cell phones assembled in China. And then secondly, trading with China also created a lot of jobs in America, specifically from the perspective of not necessarily lost manufacturing jobs, but jobs in the service industry as well. And then thirdly, by trading with China, the added benefit is that the liberal, especially from the liberal political perspective, by influencing Chinese middle class, by interacting with Chinese consumers, we are hoping that America's way of life, America's ideas might influence the Chinese people, and then change China from a relatively authoritarian regime to a more open political system. And then on the more controversial aspect of it, especially on the trade part, we have roughly speaking five primary areas of a concern. The top of which, especially we read in the headlines these days, would be national security. And that's to start with, our cell phones or social media platforms being influenced by Chinese government or controlled by Chinese government or subject to espionage and things like that. So that's national security. And then secondly, there is also the concerns about the China's unfair trade behavior or unfair trade practices that might have hurt American businesses and American interests. And then thirdly, there is the concern of job losses. The idea is China has comparative advantage in terms of producing relatively low cost goods, and that might replace a lot of manufacturing jobs here in the United States. And then fourthly, the concern would be related to environmental concerns from the perspective of the use of relatively poisonous materials or the damage to the environment. And the last but not least, there is also the concern with regard to labor rights. And a lot of these have been played out, especially in the context of Xinjiang Uyghurs and the treatment of prison laborers.
I want to get to one of those things you mentioned as a possible upside, the idea that increased trade, increased market economy was going to make the Chinese government hopefully less authoritarian. I think there's concern that with the current administration regime there, that's not happening, that Chinese authoritarian leaders have figured out how to make that not happen.
You know, Rob, I think you are you pointed you are you nailed it just now. And the idea of economic interdependence would prevent countries to go to war, and year after year we might be able to convert the other countries more like us. That's a kind of very genuine and very very missionary idea of America, of us here, right? And in many ways, I would say China has changed, and the Chinese consumers have been looking up to America and American way of life. Just by looking at the numbers of Chinese students who came to study in America and want to stay here, right? So I think that's a very positive sign. But then on the other hand, when from the ruler, from the leader's perspective, if the population inside or the citizens of a country started to have different ideas than what you tend to want them to have, that may not necessarily be a comforting sign. So I would say right now, what is facing American policymakers right now is not necessarily the Chinese consumers or the Chinese citizen or the for that matter Chinese middle class, but really is the leadership, the Communist Party's leadership.
Talking to Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at the U.S. dependency on production and trade in China. A lot of political concerns, security concerns, but a lot of interconnectedness between the economies of the two nations. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Have U.S.-China trade relations impacted your life, your income at all over the years? Would you like to see the U.S. move away from producing things in China, buying things from China? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue this conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations, looking at the future of U.S.-China trade relations. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, what you've seen maybe in your own career, your own business. Do you rely on selling stuff, agricultural products, say, to China? Call 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Alan is with us in Kenosha. Alan, hi.
Hey, and thank you for having me on. It's all, when you're dealing with China, it's all about your name. And you need to know where your name is and where you live. And I think we really need to recognize that people in Shanghai, Taiwan, that these are our current economic friends within the larger administration. The holdover, nobody wants to be part of the CCP elite, and I think that's where a lot of this is going for right now.
Alan, thanks a lot for the call. He mentioned Shanghai, Taiwan, of course, a separate country, unless, of course, you ask the leaders of mainland China. But Alan, making a point that I think you were getting at, Zoe, that we might be trading with elements, with business groups in China, and that's not the same thing, Alan says, as supporting the Chinese Communist Party, the current regime in China.
I think what Alan made a great point there, recognizing that actually China is a very heterogeneous country, and where you live actually determines your interest. So from that perspective, it's very much similar to here in the United States. Like, for example, if China wanted to open up and practice free trade, a lot of these major cities on the ocean area is going to be very happy. For example, like Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Shanghai benefited tremendously from trading with the United States, but less so for the inland area. So I think Alan made a great point there.
Thanks for the call, Alan. Gary joins us now in Ripon. Gary, hi.
Hello. I think there's a certain falseness even in referring to this as trade, since the great, great preponderance of the money is going all one way and not so much the other. I mean, we're funding communist China to a much tremendously greater degree than they fund us.
Gary, thanks for the call. And Zoe, Gary hitting on a concern from many in the U.S. that the trade, there's a gap, a deficit, more money flowing out to China than into the United States.
You know, Gary, that is a very interesting observation you made there. And I have to say, yes, you actually touched upon the issue of what we would say, economists would refer to that as a trade deficit. The idea is we are buying more Chinese goods than the Chinese are buying from us. But the other side of the trade deficit is the so-called foreign exchange reserves that have been accumulated by the Chinese central bank. And because of the nature of the Chinese system and the relatively lack of sophisticated financial market, China, or for that matter, the Chinese People's Bank of China, the central bank, it had limited options, but had to invest in U.S. treasuries. In other words, actually right now, what we are seeing is China has been the largest foreign exchange, China has been the largest U.S. treasury holders for quite some time. So from that matter, we are, by running a larger trade deficit with China, we are also sort of hijacking China to invest in U.S. treasuries.
Thanks for the call, Gary. Mike joins us now in the Fox River Valley. Mike, hello.
Hi. Wisconsin had a thriving paper and printing industry that up until sometime in the mid-90s, all the printing that I see now, publications, magazines, some of the large books are all printed in China, and it breaks my heart because cities like Wisconsin Rapids and Wausau and Appleton, there was a lot of lost jobs in the paper industry, and those were very high-paying, well jobs in the printing industry. Was also something that surrounding states like Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, Illinois didn't lose as much as Wisconsin did.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. And Mike hits on, I think, a big concern that in certain communities and certain industries, we had a very concentrated negative impact from opening up trade with China, including printing here in Wisconsin, Zoe.
Yes, absolutely. And Mike's point with regard to printing and paper industry, I think that's a good example. Another good example that might have suffered from, especially from the trade war with China, is the ginseng growing industry in Wisconsin. I grew up in China, and a lot of my relatives there are major consumers of Wisconsin ginseng. And but after trade war, they recognized that in order to buy ginseng tea made from Wisconsin, the price increased by more than a half. So from that perspective, the trade war with China is hurting our communities in Wisconsin, but it's also hurting the Chinese consumers.
Thanks for that call. So I want to take our last couple of minutes to look at the alternatives. If the American political system decides, yes, we want to extricate ourselves from this much trade with China, what could that look like? What kind of options would be on the table to say we're going to buy fewer microchips and printed goods, and the list goes on and on from China.
Oh yeah, that's a great mental exercise. But I would have to take a step back and say, if we were leaving a complete, if we were heading towards a complete trade decoupling with China, we are going to see, you know, whenever you go to, we go to the grocery store, we are going to have to pay a lot more. For our whatever we are buying now, and then on top of that, we probably will couple that with inflationary pressure. We're probably a lot of our middle class people here in the United States are going to suffer, not because of our diminished relationship with China, but also simply from the price pressure perspective. And then on the other hand, I do not think fully decoupling with China is going to be easily achieved. And if we just take the supply chain divorce these days, you know, dominant headline, for example, I would argue that a complete supply chain divorce from China would be extremely difficult, and it would not happen overnight. Take, you know, the iPhone, for example. Like right now, about 98% of iPhones have been assembled in China, and that is the result of more than 2 decades of effort that Apple has been putting in their building supply chains in China. And if Apple were to remove their productions to China, it's probably going to take them about by 2030, Apple would at most move 10% of their production capacity out of China. So from that perspective, I do not think decoupling is going to happen anytime soon.
Zoe, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob, and thank you for our audience.
That was Zoe Liu, a fellow for international political economy at the Council on Foreign Relations. She joined us today to talk about the future of U.S.-China trade relations. Wisconsin's population is aging. State estimates show that almost a quarter of residents will be 65 or older by 2040. Helping people stay mobile as they age is critical to help them maintain their quality of life and independence. But local public transit agencies and nonprofits are already struggling to do that. Jonah Chester reports.
It's a warm October day in Green Bay, and Kathy Koch has a dentist appointment to get to.
All right.
Hold it right there, and I'll come on the other side.
Okay, sounds good.
Koch is 79 and has lived in the same home for more than half a century. She relies on a walker to get around, and she can't drive herself to the office.
My husband's been dead for a while, so to ask the children, it's difficult. They all work. The grandchildren all work.
Koch relies on an organization called Curative Connections. The Green Bay nonprofit provides services, including transportation, to the elderly and people with disabilities. As the driver helps her out of the van, she says Curative is also a connection to her community.
Oh, I love the human contact.
Yeah, it's very important.
It doesn't happen very often. I'm going to let you get the belt.
People over 65 are becoming a larger and larger portion of Wisconsin's population. That means more people will rely on specialized transportation to stay mobile. But without more support, Wisconsin's paratransit systems may not be ready to support the state's aging population. Like other states, Wisconsin received transportation funding through federal infrastructure and COVID aid bills. Green Bay Metro Transit Director Patty Kiewiz says that money was helpful, but wasn't a permanent fix.
So I think the next few years here will be, you know, in a much better position than we have been. But, you know, that's also something you need to be careful of, is that's really kind of one-time money. Then what are we going to do in a couple, you know, in 3 years?
That's a multi-million dollar question. The largest source of state funding to improve transit for the elderly and disabled hasn't risen in years. And other state transit spending fell to its lowest level in more than a decade last year. Green Bay Metro has coped with declining funds by cutting and consolidating bus routes and paratransit services. They're trying to fill the gaps with a local ride-hailing app. Organizations like Curative Connections are trying to patch the remaining cracks in the system, but they're also facing the economic challenges of inflation and higher gas prices. Curative's transportation director, Tina Wietung, says they've also lost about half of their volunteer drivers since the beginning of the pandemic, and they can't afford to replace all of them with paid drivers.
We've had to limit the number of rides based on volunteer and driver availability. So we're down probably 30% compared to prior years before COVID.
Advocates say on-demand services like Curative are important, but still imperfect. Tamara Jackson co-chairs the Non-Driver Advisory Committee for the Wisconsin Department of Transportation. She says many paratransit resources are concentrated in urban areas.
Public transit often ends at jurisdictional boundaries. So a lot of times, even if there is public transit available, you know, it might end at the county line or the city line.
Even within those jurisdictions, there can be gaps.
Public transit simply isn't everywhere where people need to go.
Changing that would mean a significant shift in how local and state officials design their services. So what's the solution?
This is both a funding and a structural puzzle to solve.
Denise Jess is another co-chair of the Non-Driver Advisory Committee. Jess is also legally blind and a non-driver, so she's experienced many of the barriers she's trying to address.
My invitation is that the state legislature really comes to the table and works with us on this very complex transportation problem that we face in this state.
Governor Tony Evers and state legislators will have the chance to do that when work on the next state budget begins in February. Jonah Chester, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, we'll look at the quest for a new House Speaker with the Republican majority still trying to figure out who that's going to be. Plus, we'll look ahead at some of the big issues facing Congress in 2023 with a narrow Republican majority in the House, narrow Democratic majority in the U.S. Senate. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a professional football player suffered cardiac arrest on the field after a hit on Monday night. We'll talk to a sports columnist about why this incident has touched so many people and how it affects the sport as a whole. Now, the new Congress started its session on Tuesday with a narrow Democratic majority in the Senate and a narrow Republican majority in the House. But it hasn't been business as usual on the House side of things so far. A group of Republican holdouts have taken the vote for House Speaker into multiple ballots, calling for an alternative to Representative Kevin McCarthy or major concessions. We're checking out the unusual speakerless situation and taking a look at the issues facing Congress in 2023. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this delayed speaker situation a big deal to you? What do you make of what's going on among Republicans as this continues? And what do you want to see from Congress when it comes to things like spending, taxes, investigations, immigration, you name it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. David Cannon is a professor of political science at UW-Madison. David, welcome back to the show.
Good to be with you.
Well, nothing is really unprecedented, but I was just looking at NPR. Last time we went to a ninth ballot to get a speaker was just shy of 100 years ago. We've passed that now. The ninth ballot looks like it's failed. You're going back to 1859 when we've gotten into double digits. What do you make of this?
Yeah, this really is unprecedented. I mean, it's something that we haven't seen, as you said, for 164 years. And you don't expect the process of just electing a speaker to be something this contentious. But you have the holdouts of 20 members now who have just locked into their opposition to Kevin McCarthy, and they're just saying they won't budge. And McCarthy has been making more and more concessions over the last couple of days, meeting several of the specific demands that they've made, but he still has not been able to budge a single one of the 20 holdouts.
Wisconsin Representative Mike Gallagher, a Republican, nominated McCarthy on, I think it was the fourth try. And speaking, he downplayed concerns about the situation, claimed the media and Democrats are making too big a deal about it. Here's a listen.
But I think my friends on the Democratic side misunderstand what's happening here. Sure, it looks messy, but democracy is messy. Democracy is messy by design.
So not a big deal, he says. Nothing to see here.
Well, I agree with Representative Gallagher that democracy is messy. There's no doubt about that. But this is part of the process that has been routine for over 100 years. We haven't had a contested ballot for the speaker for 100 years. And this comes with having stronger political parties in Congress. You have to go back to the pre-Civil War era where the contested speakership races were quite common back then. We had one in 1956 that won 133 ballots. That's the longest one ever. It lasted 2 months before they got that result. And so, and then 1859, one you mentioned, was 44 ballots. And so the contested speaker races were quite common before the Civil War, but parties were weaker. We didn't have the same established set of institutions that we have today. So for the last 100 years, this hasn't happened. So it is quite unusual.
We've got this small Republican majority. That's what makes this possible. Do you see the holdouts here being, I guess, somehow ideologically different than the rest of the Republican Party? Or is this procedural disagreements or tactical differences? What do you see driving this?
Well, so it's both procedural and tactical and ideological. I think all of those things are coming into play here. Fundamentally, this is the right wing of the Republican Party. These are some of the most extreme conservatives in the Republican Party. But they do have some differences also with Kevin McCarthy on how they're anticipating the speakership would work. And they want to devolve some of the power from the speakership back to committees. They want to try to make the legislative process more committee-centered rather than leadership-centered. And that's something, obviously, the speaker is resisting. And so some of the other things like the so-called no confidence votes, where that's something that they also demanded on the motion to vacate. McCarthy initially said he wouldn't give in to that at all. Then he said, well, I'll allow a motion to vacate with five members, ask for it. They still wanted to go to just having a single member ask for a motion to vacate, which is basically, again, a vote of no confidence for the speaker. And McCarthy agreed to that. But even after agreeing to that last night, he still wasn't able to convince any of the holdouts to vote for him. So it's not clear, as Senator John Cornyn said yesterday, how they're going to land this plane. I don't know how they're going to get out of this deadlock.
All right, assuming that they land the plane and we end up with a speaker, I'm guessing that's going to happen at some point. It raises the concern for a new speaker that this slim majority could have the same trouble with any particular issue. This could really come back and bite you, even if you end up being the speaker.
Well, right. I think that is the concern here, is that whoever ends up becoming speaker is going to have a much weaker position than you would ideally want the leadership to have. And especially, as you noted, the slim margins. You can only lose four people in the majority party right now to be able to pass anything. And so that makes it all the more important to be able to have a unified majority party if you want to get anything done. And so if you're in a position where any five members can basically veto the party position, one of two things is going to happen: either complete gridlock where nothing gets done. And this especially becomes a concern for things like being able to raise the debt ceiling. Are we going to default on our debt for the first time in our history? Well, we might if the majority party absolutely is, committed to, not doing it. And unless you have at least some Republicans willing to cross over and vote for Democrats who would be, able to raise the debt ceiling then, this really could put the country in a difficult spot.
Talking to David Cannon, political scientist at UW-Madison, looking ahead at the year in Congress, big issues facing Congress in 2023, and the developing news today, the quest to get a speaker of the U.S. House. Without a speaker, nobody gets sworn in. Then what happens? You can join in with your thoughts, your questions, either on today's situation or what you want to see or not see in Congress in the next few months, call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Willem is with us in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I'd like to see the new Congress continue to pursue the, you know, the, not to bury this January 6th investigation because, you know, this is unprecedented and no president in our history has ever done what the former president attempted to do unconstitutionally, continue his presidency. And I think I've heard that the radical wing of the Republican Party is interested in investigating Hunter Biden, who, as far as I'm concerned, is a private citizen.
Willem, I got you some background noise there. But, David, this is a thing that a chamber of Congress can do, investigations, even if, you know, the other chamber is in the opposite party's control. Willem, concerned that the Trump investigation will probably end, which it seems like it will, and that Hunter Biden investigations will begin. It seems like that probably will. This power to investigate, what are you looking at?
Well, right. There's no doubt that that is one of the clear consequences of divided government. Whenever you have one party controlling at least one chamber and the president being controlled by the other party, you do always see an increase in the number of investigations. That happens whether it's a Democratic president or Republican president, a Republican or Democratic House. You definitely see an increase in the number of oversight investigations. And so I think that is a given that that will happen. Now, on the January 6th committee, there that also is another concern about that is not only that they will disband the committee, which is definitely going to happen, but also what happens to the documents. Now, the Democrats already have made everything public. They dumped everything on the internet. They're available now to the public. But one thing that the Republicans appear to be heading towards doing is not depositing all of those documents in the National Archives the way that typically would be done, but instead having the records transferred to the House Administration Committee. And that's something that, again, raises some concern about having all of these documents, then all of the original transcripts and interviews and so on, not being held in the National Archives will make it much more difficult to potentially have public access as opposed to, you know, having it in the House Administration Committee.
Thanks for the call, Willem. Staying with investigations, David, there's been some talk of investigating the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan and the quick collapse of the Afghan army. It seems like that could be a good and productive thing, potentially. That's something that should get a look back or maybe longer term look at the U.S. role in Afghanistan. Do you see a prospect for, you know, a genuine fact-finding investigation of those things, or do you see it as a maybe more likely to dissolve into a partisan tool?
Well, I think you're good. It's a good example to point to that as something that could potentially be productive. And you're right, that would be good to be able to get to the bottom of what was widely perceived as a failure. Like that was just did not go well. We ended up having, you know, many of the people who have been supporting our effort there being left to the hands of the Taliban. And it just really was not a good situation. And another one I would put in that category as well is an oversight investigation they're talking about doing concerning the coronavirus pandemic and how to prevent future pandemics. Both of those things could be productive and positive if they'd be done in a comprehensive way that really tried to get to the bottom of both of those issues. But if they simply become a tool for, you know, beating up President Biden, and that doesn't then serve the purpose of trying to prevent this type of thing from happening in the future.
Talking to David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at the new Congress, the leadership drama in the new Republican majority in the House, and some of the big issues in the year ahead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions about today's news or the road ahead for Congress this year, what you want to see your elected representatives focusing on, what you don't want to see them focusing on. Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with David Cannon, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at the latest from the new session of Congress, off to an unusual start on the House side of things, still looking for a speaker. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions. That's 800-642-1234. 1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jack is with us in Milwaukee. Jack, hello.
Hello. The question I've got is related to the potential removal of a speaker. With the proposals they have thus far, what's your view as to how long you might actually turn the House into the House of Commons in England, with everything basically in a state of chaos?
Yeah, well, the vote of no confidence, you know, certainly does sound a lot like the House of Commons. It's the type of thing that, you know, that you do see not just in Great Britain, but in a lot of European countries where, you know, you do have a turnover in government. What would be different, though, with the situation with the motion to vacate in the House of talking about doing versus the true vote of no confidence in a parliamentary system is that a true vote of no confidence brings down the entire government. It's not just the leader of one of the legislative chambers. And so that is, you know, is different because there the prime minister is tied to the majority governing party. Mm-hmm. And so it's more of a unified system. You can't have divided government in a parliamentary system. So it is a difference that makes it not quite as consequential here as it would be in a parliamentary system.
Jack, thanks for the question. David, in a speakerless House as we have now, I understand members can't be sworn in until there's a speaker. They're limited in their ability to do constituent services. Like, how much is lost if there is a non-existent House right now?
Well, no, it's really a potentially, you know, huge problem if this goes on much longer. Even some things like the daily security briefings that happen, you know, every day. You have security briefings for the people on the Intelligence Committee and other, you know, House leaders. That's not happening right now because we don't have a House. So if you had some type of international crisis, you know, we wouldn't have a House of Representatives to deal with that. And so there are some, you know, really serious potential issues if this drags on much longer, where the House literally can't do anything. They can't hold committee meetings. They can't, you know, have any kind of business. And this really could become more consequential if it goes on much longer.
Go back to our callers at 800-642-1234 with Jim on the line in Dubuque. Hi, Jim.
Hi, I'm happy to see the 20 holdouts persist in trying to get some alternative to Mr. McCarthy. I and many people believe that he's too much of the old school compromised legislators on more allegiance to lobbyists and special interests, and that there's a number of critical issues that will not be investigated if he's put in place. He will protect the entrenched forces.
Jim, thanks for the call. And David, that is the argument from at least some of the Republican holdouts as to why they want not Kevin McCarthy.
Well, that's right. I think that is one of the main arguments that they're making, is that he is too tied to the, you know, the Washington establishment. And they want someone, you know, more in their, you know, wing of the party, someone, you know, more like Jim Jordan, I suppose, who would, you know, shake things up more and would be more aggressive in terms of the oversight and investigations. I think that's pretty clear. But another consequence of this holdout is it could potentially go the other way. We haven't talked yet about the efforts of Don Bacon and the Republican from Nebraska. And just since we went on the air, there was a meeting of 80 to 90 members of the so-called Main Street Republicans that he is a member of. And he's the one that's been talking about potentially reaching out to Democrats and trying to find some compromise with them to elect a more moderate Republican. And so that's the other direction this could potentially go. Now, my view is if that happens, and if Don Bacon and his colleagues end up trying to start talking to the Democrats about electing someone who's, you know, more to the center, I think that would probably be what it would take to bring the 20 holdouts on board and say, okay, we'd rather have Kevin McCarthy than, say, Liz Cheney, for example. You know, if they would, you know, come up with someone like that, or Fred Upton, that would be something that would be not at all acceptable to the 20 holdouts.
Talking to David Cannon, UW-Madison political science professor, looking at today's news in the U.S. House of Representatives, looking ahead to what is on the table in Congress in 2023. Back to your calls now. Jed is with us in Le Coudre. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
Well,
I had an original comment, and then something just came to me, which is, why do they keep voting if there's been no progress or if there's been no votes changed or deals brokered? I'm just wondering how many times, you know, we've gone from 8, now 9, and then 10 and 11. Why do they vote 3 times a day if nothing changes?
I got you, Jed. Interesting question. If you don't have the votes, why hold the vote?
Well, it is a really good question. I think it's the question that a lot of people are asking right now, including me, and there's no good answer to that. Because you would expect that they wouldn't keep on holding votes unless they had some indication that some people were willing to change. And so I don't know how much longer McCarthy can continue if there's not any shift in the numbers, because on the last vote, we were told from some McCarthy supporters that you're going to start to see the number shrinking. It's going to go down from 20 to 15. And once that starts to happen and it starts moving in that direction, then you can say, okay, keep on voting. Maybe the margins will keep on shrinking, but that just hasn't happened. It's been absolutely stable, since the voting started, with marginal shifts here and there. People, one person voted for Donald Trump earlier today, for example. So there's a little bit of change, but the basic numbers have not changed. And so I completely agree that this really doesn't make sense at this point to continue with voting until you have some idea that something's going to change.
Thanks for that call. All right, David, again, supposing we end up with a speaker at some point, let's look ahead at the year in policy matters that we might expect Congress to deal with. Divided control, of course, of Congress. Are there issues that you think they're going to have to work on, and they're going to have to come up with some kind of compromises between a Republican House and a Democratic Senate?
Well, the big ones, of course, are the budget, and the immediate situation that they will have to deal with sometime this spring is the debt ceiling, because that will have to be extended again as early as 2 months from now. They might be able to push it back, 3-4 months, but no longer than that. And that's what's required to avoid defaulting on the federal debt. So that's the first, must pass thing. And my guess is what will happen there is it'll pass with largely Democratic votes, with a handful of Republicans joining. Now, that could be tricky if you have, someone that is endorsed by the Freedom Caucus, so someone more to the right. You'd have to do something like a discharge petition that would require the signatures of 218 people, to get that bill out of committee if the majority leadership is opposed to this, which the last time this happened and we came close to defaulting was back during the Obama years. But there, the leadership did allow a vote to come up, and it did pass in with Democratic support and some Republican support. So I'm guessing that's probably what's going to happen again.
Time for one more question from a caller. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hi. I have a hypothetical. What if some of the Republicans actually cross the aisle and vote for the Democrat to become Speaker of the House, even though they're in the minority? What would happen then?
John, thanks for the call. David?
Well that could happen. In fact, we saw it happen yesterday in Pennsylvania, where they had an unusual situation in their state legislature where the Democrats on Election Day had a majority, but two of the newly elected members died after the election. And so the Republicans actually had a slim majority. So you actually had a couple of Republicans cross over and vote with the Democrats to elect a Democrat, but with a more independently minded Democrat, even despite the fact Republicans had a majority in the legislature at the time. So that could conceivably happen. I think that's very unlikely. I think the thing that's more likely would be what I mentioned with Don Bacon from Nebraska, and some other more moderate Republicans coming up with a moderate Republican alternative that would be more acceptable to the Democrats than Kevin McCarthy even. And that could get the votes then of the 212 Democrats with a handful of 6 Republicans. And you could potentially elect a moderate Republican with those votes. But I don't think it's conceivable unless you'd have 6 Republicans willing to change parties, basically, because if they would actually vote for a Democrat, they'd be kicked out of the Republican Party for sure.
John, thanks for the question. And David, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Okay, it was good to be with you. Interesting times.
Definitely. We've been talking to David Cannon, professor of political science at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at the opening days of the new session of Congress, the leadership kerfuffle for the new Republican majority, and some of the big issues facing Congress in the year to come. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a lot of people put their bikes away for the Wisconsin winter, but not everybody. Meet the winter bikers in the state. Get some advice if you want to give it a try and share your own experiences if you do it. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network.